Pick up your paintbrush. It's time for Hobby Support Group. Good evening, Charles.
Good evening, Tom.
Hello, listeners. Today, we're having a chat with one of our favourite guests of the podcast, Mr. Charles Rowntree, where we're talking both the legacy of the Imjin board that we talked about now, I think, 2 years ago, and the Battle of Scarif Rogue One inspired board that was touring the show circuit last year, and it's got one outing left, I believe, this year. Is that right, Charles?
That's correct, yes. Its last outing will be at Hammerhead on the 3rd of March.
So, to have you on again. It's always an inspiration to, you know, chat and see whatever your sort of like mind-boggling hobby projects you're working on at the time. I'm sure you're the envy of most of us.
Thank you very much for having me back. Well, it's a pleasure.
So maybe we'll sort of start off with the Imjin board. Now, that is now in its sort of like final resting home at the Gloucester's Museum. Is that right?
That's right. It's at the Soldiers of Gloucestershire Museum, which is based on the docks in Gloucester. And I think they say that there's something like the regimental museum for something like 40 potential British Army regiments or battalions, if you trace all of their antecedents all the way as far back as you can go. So it's not simply just for the glorious Gloucesters, but it's from quite a lot of the various regiments there. But it is the regimental museum for the Gloucesters, and they have a special room, the career room, to commemorate the Gloucester service in 1951.
That's quite nice, because I think lots of those sort of like regimental museums or like the yeomanry museums, that they can be quite often sort of tucked away that you sort of don't know where they are. Do you? I know like the Sherman Yeomanry one, it's almost like at the back of a garden centre. So obviously didn't know.
Well, the Gloucestershire Museum's in a beautiful building. I think it's some kind of Georgian. It's actually quite a large building, and it is literally right on the dock, so it's easily accessible, it's got, I think, about four floors, and there's kind of a winding route all the way through the museum, and you go past the red coats from Marlborough times and Wellington's times, and then through Indian Mutiny and all the various periods, right up to the modern day, and they've got all of these various different elements, after I kind of made the board, I kind of rang them up and said, hey, look, would you like this? And they were like, oh, you've got a diorama. And I went, well, it's not really quite a diorama. It's kind of this. And they went, well, send us some pictures. And then I sent them some pictures. And then the guy is kind of like, wow. Yeah, we really, that would be really, really cool. That would be absolutely fantastic. So that was kind of really kind of a really big, big thing for me. It kind of felt like I wasn't just taking advantage of the kind of the Gloucesters and kind of doing my own thing. I could actually give a little bit of something back, and you know, the missus wanted rid of the board anyway, but it felt like I could actually do something worthwhile with that. So I said to them, well, look, I can come and run the game. I'll come down, and I'll run the game, and we'll do a full refight of the whole battle. And they liked the idea, and so we got access to what they have is what they call the boardroom. But this is kind of a meeting room, and it's got a huge Victorian table in it with about 20 chairs that you can kind of get around in it, breaks out and so on. So we kind of got that done. And my best mate, David Vasilevsky, who wrote the rule set that I use, agreed to kind of come down with me. And over the May Day bank holiday weekend last year, the last outing for me for the Gloucesters board is we did a refi of the battle in the museum and kind of set it up so that as visitors came into the museum, they would be gradually funneled up to the top of the building into the boardroom, and then they could kind of come in. And what we did was we grabbed hold of them and got them to take either the roles of the Chinese or the Gloucesters as we kind of did a rewrite. And the thing about the Imogen battle is that it's 3 days long, or 3 nights long for the Gloucesters. So we did 1 day's worth of fighting on each day of our kind of visit, and then that way people could kind of dip in and so on, and kind of see what happened and see the progress that the Chinese made in isolating the Gloucesters. And it was fantastic. We met soldiers that had served in the Gloucesters. We met one gentleman who'd served with soldiers that had actually been present. We met a number of people that had had family. So there was one gentleman whose father had been there, and others who'd had uncles and grandfathers. So it was really nice to kind of see them and kind of talk to them a little bit about what it was, and they could actually see on the terrain and how awful the terrain is there, and how desperate the fight was, and for them to kind of understand at least numbers wise and scale wise just how badly outnumbered the Gloucesters were, and what an absolutely heroic fight it was from their point. Their point of view, and I mean for the Chinese as well, it must have been a dreadful battle. And pleasingly, the Gloucesters lasted until the final morning. I think they started with 31 stands on the table, and they ended up, I think we had about 3 or 4 that were left on the table by the final morning, which pretty much is when they ran out of ammunition, but more importantly, they ran out of radio batteries. But disappointingly, nobody managed to get a Gloucester off the table. I've run it about 6 or 7 times, and I think only once did anybody ever manage to get a Gloucester to walk off the table, whereas the actual Gloucesters managed to get 46 guys out of the Chinese encirclement. It was absolutely fantastic to be kind of able to do that, and then I could just leave the board behind. It's on display at the museum now. And very kindly they send me the occasional update to let me know what's kind of going on with it. And They have a thing every so often during the summer and the holidays where they let you act as a kind of a tank commander. So they've got some kind of scope that you can kind of use that gives you this view through kind of the optics of a tank. And they kind of put little miniatures out, and you kind of have to decide from whatever profile and angle it's at, is that an enemy tank or is that a friendly vehicle? And then you kind of get to say whether you fire or not. You've kind of got to swivel this stuff around and do that. And they're actually using the Imogen board for people to kind of be able to do that. So I'm really pleased that they're finding something useful for it rather than just letting it stand there and gather dust.
Well, I think it's incredibly fitting that it's ended up in a museum, because I will stand by the thing. I think it's the most impressive hobby thing I think I've ever seen. I think it, like, when I first saw it, it sort of like blew my socks off. And then having to then, like, but also being able to play on it as well, and having, like, played on it a couple of times, it is, I think it's astounding how not only does it look so amazing, but actually plays really well as well. So, because it's not a it is sort of a diorama in a way, I would say, but it's kind of like a giant topographical diorama that is also a very functional gaming sort of piece. It plays what it does, what it needs to do to game on, and you can play it. Like my last question is about it. You answered my question of how did like the various games end? Because of, you know, not many Gloucesters sort of survived. Not theirs, but how did the board itself, as actually like an item, sort of withstand like doing the like dice being rolled on it in and out of the car and at various shows? Did you have to do much sort of, you know, running surgery to sort of keep it going, or did it survive unscathed?
It was beginning to feel it at the edges, but it wasn't to the point where I was having to do surgery. There was the odd chip here or there on the edge, but generally the boards had survived remarkably well, I think. And it's testament. I mean, I built them using Luke from Geek Gaming Scenics method with MDF baseboard with battens around the edge, screwed around the edges, and then polystyrene infill into the middle, and then that's your basic surface. And that was kind of my starting point, and it's testament to the way that Luke approached that actually the board was remarkably resilient. I mean, there was a lot of additional support. So I think it had 3mm plywood around the edge that was cut to the right heights for the folds. And that again was done and sanded to the right level. So my edges were pretty robust, but even the dice rolling didn't affect it. That was fine. Some of the figures were feeling the pain from being picked up hundreds of times. But yes, I was really, really pleased with it. And yeah, didn't have to do anything significant. Just the odd bit here or there.
Well, I think that must be a huge testament. Also, it's like your build quality as well, though, Charles, because it's one thing following a plan to make it manageable. But I know, like, the terrain that, like, we build for the club, you know, as one night of the club thing, is, well, we have to have, like, terrain Sunday once a month to touch things up, which have been painted and up, up and down the country in the back of the car.
Or,
you know, multiple, like, 2 or 3 days people played, like, hundreds of people coming up and hitting in backpacks and all sorts of things. So moving on, the Imjin board, like, how big was it, its footprint? I can't quite remember
exactly. It's 6 foot by 4 foot, so 1800 by 1200. And it's three boards that are 600 by 1200, so it's 3 4-foot by 2-foot boards that kind of just join together.
But I think like that one didn't kind of quite give you enough sort of like challenges for sort of travel and moving it around, anything. It is, you sort of thought, well how can I sort of like outdo myself this year on something that, because I know them when I first saw the Scarif board, it was an order of magnitude larger, we'll sort of say, in the far more in-depth things, in that, you know, we did, I suppose it's a bit of a 180 from the Imjins and the super historical Gloucesters and all the, like, the specifically, like, made little houses that he'd made out of the 1mm batten and stuff. Just suddenly look at something and you go, oh, there's a TIE fighter zipping around the top of my head. So, yeah, the board that you took out, the board that you did last year, for any listeners who didn't know, was inspired by like the Battle of Scarif, wasn't it? For the like the desert planet from the Rogue One movie, for any of you that's not a nerd.
Yes, it was filmed in the Maldives, I think, that bit of the film. So yes, for anybody that hasn't seen Rogue One, I would advise you to pause the podcast right now, go watch it and come back in 2 hours' time, because there are probably going to be quite a lot of spoilers ahead as we kind of go. But yeah, it's the epic battle that is the culmination of Rogue One, a Star Wars story. And you know, from my point of view, and I think more or less everybody that comes up to me and expresses opinion says it's the best Star Wars movie of the recent bunch by quite some distance.
You mean like the best Star Wars movie since sort of like about 1982?
Yes, I think it is right up there. There are some absolutely fantastic concepts and scenes and so on, and at the end of the battle, there is an enormous fight involving X-Wings, TIE fighters, Star Destroyers, Shield Gates, Commandos, Stormtroopers, Death Troopers, at ACTs. It is just epic, and it all takes place on a whole series of islands surrounding what they call the giant Citadel Tower, it's got such an iconic look that pretty much everybody that sees it, that's seen the movie, kind of goes, I know what that is. Whenever they see my board, and you know, yeah, yes, I've done a fairly good job at recreating what the filmmakers did, but actually the filmmakers have created an image and scenes and battles that actually are imprinted, and even people that have just seen it kind of once kind of remember, I've seen that before, memorable and fantastic, and the you know, one of the big things about it is just the colors. You know, you have a dark gray, almost black tower towering over a battlefield with sea that is of the deepest blue that you can imagine, and greenery that is just so vibrant. And it does create an absolutely iconic look to my mind in terms of the whole piece. But yes, it is a bit of a departure from my previous things, because I kind of done World War II stuff before. I've done Arnhem and I've done Brecourt Manor, and then you know, even the Imjin is proto World War II with a little bit of steroids and some jet fighters. I kind of looked at it and went, right, okay, so the size of the Imjin, 6 foot by 4 foot, is about right. That's kind of how big a board I can transport. It's the size of a board that I can fit in the car. So can I do something really different that just challenges me in kind of a different way? So the Imjin was all about contours. It was all about how do I create hills and valleys and everything else? How do I sculpt that? How do I represent a river? How do I represent villages in really tiny scale and paddy fields and kind of the brush and the scenery? And I thought, well, you know, there's no point kind of redoing anything kind of similar. Let's go off and do something else. So I don't know when I kind of came up with the idea to kind of do Scarif. I can't remember what was what was the actual aha moment. But I know I saw Dan Hodgson put on his Hoth game at Joy of Six, maybe 2016, maybe 2017, not sure which year it was. And it was the first time I met Dan, and I didn't know him then. But my eldest son was about 8 or 9, and he spent a couple of hours very happily with Dan playing Dan's Assault on Echo bass from Hoth. And I've since bought all of the various bits and pieces to allow me to recreate Echo Bass, and just not got around to it. So I have painted a table up that I can use for Hoth, and I've painted scenery and kind of done that. I just haven't got around to doing the rest of it. So I think kind of at some point I was thinking, well, what else? What could I do in the Star Wars world? And you know, Dan's already done that, so you know, I'm not going to do that. But then at the back of your mind, you're kind of thinking, yeah, well, Rogue One, maybe that'll do. That could be interesting. And it's just kind of right. Well, you know, how would I do it? And how do you do it? And what are the kind of the bits and pieces? And then you start thinking, right, okay, so. What are the challenges to kind of doing that? And you know, well, the first one is the Citadel Tower. Okay, yeah, but yeah, I can do a tower. I can probably do a tower. That's okay. And then it's kind of like, all right, okay. So if I can do that, right, then well, I've got to do a C. Well, lots of people do Cs. That's okay. That's fine. I can figure out how to do a C. And okay, I need some figures. Okay, well, it's going to be 6mm, so okay, that shouldn't be a problem. Oh hey, there's this guy that's selling Rogue One figures in 6mm. Oh fantastic! Right, so all right, I'll order some of them. Right, that's not a problem. He's not even doing it legally distinct. He's just got that on, so right, so that's the figures taken care of, that's fine. And then, well, you know, I just need to do trees and, you know, brush and cut. Yeah, well, that's not going to be hard. I'm used to kind of doing that, so that's fine. So you kind of look at it and you think, ah, yeah, actually that's not bad. And you know, I go through a kind of a planning and exploration phase for all of my projects, where you know, you kind of just getting all the stuff together and you're just getting images, you get ideas and you just start storing them. So I just dump them in a file on the computer and just kind of stick them there and think, right, okay, yeah, this is a thing. And just kind of going through it, and just as you know, about 50% of the time, you just either put it on the back burner or you just go, no, that won't work. But then as you're kind of working through and just looking at all of these various bits and pieces and knowing, yeah, that's okay, that can kind of work, and yeah, that's fine. And then it starts to get a momentum all of its kind of its own. And then the next thing you know, somebody asks you, what's your next project? And then you kind of blurt out, I'm going to do this. And then at that point, you're kind of, oh, yes, I am, actually. I'm going to do that. And you suddenly start going, right, okay, better get on with this then. So that was kind of the genesis of the idea, was kind of, let's do something different, and then kind of doing it, kind of thinking through, well, what do I have to overcome, and how do I kind of think I'm going to do that? And it's not even I don't kind of go, and how am I going to play the game at the end of it? I don't start with that. I just start with, well, actually, I'm sure there's a game in there somewhere. All I have to do is build the terrain, and then the game will follow. And so you're then into kind of the build, and there's this is the point where you actually start to get to grips with the reality of kind of the undertaking. And whereas Imjin was layers upon layers kind of building up, and it was just hills and contours. Scarif is the islands are all one level. There's absolutely no contouring involved, but you kind of go into another scale because you have this enormous tower to build. And when I start looking at what other people had done, there were lots and lots of games, and the people had kind of done and organized. But I couldn't find anybody that had really built the tower in its full glory. So you have this kind of iconic tower, which is the focus of the battle. And it's kind of sits in the middle of all of these islands, and it's in this great circle surrounded by a massive water reservoir that I kind of assume and presume it's because it's a massive data warehouse, and they just need hundreds of millions of gallons of water to cool all of the processing equipment. So you have this tower sat in the middle of all of this water, and there are these great weirs at various points surrounding it that the water is cascading through and falls into a reservoir before it's kind of sucked up into this kind of tower. And nobody that I'd seen had really built the infrastructure that tower sat on. They just built the tower itself. And I thought, okay, so that's something I can bring that's kind of new to the project. I can kind of do that nobody's ever kind of approached. And I thought that's going to be a really nice, interesting modeling challenge, because I'm trying to recreate a really, really complex base for the tower. And it's kind of like, okay, that's great. That gives my piece some focus, because if I'm not careful, I just end up building some islands and some sea, and it's a really simplistic kind of
Well,
ball.
I think you're sort of doing yourself a disservice saying it's really simple. I think definitely something that I was really astounded with when we were seeing the in progress things of it was actually what you did, and even from having seen the movie a few times, you don't realize how detailed the world is that's built in the movie until you sort of see it all on the base. I think the tower of the base. The base of the tower is the Imperial logo sort of thing, which I'd never noticed until you sort of built it. And I think it's the I would imagine it must have been a real challenge sort of taking all those little bits that are created for the movie, and it might be, well, this bit's you're gonna have a close-up of this scene here, and then a close-up of this scene that's set in this different part of the islands, and then having
Yes.
to sort of make them all join together and actually go, well, now we've now got to have a scale model of this whole thing that is real and works, rather
Yes.
than just the bits that are sort of shown on camera. And I know lots of the bits that you built sort of they're on screen for sort of a millisecond, or they're sort of they're only ever in the sort of the background periphery. So
Yes.
it must have been a real challenge to sort of all that sort of infrastructure scaling and all that sort of stuff. And well, yeah, there's a water tank at the end of this pier here, so there's got to be a pipe that gets the water to there from there. And that's all the sort of the detailing that you sort of put on that, isn't it? Which I think,
Yeah.
even if like you're not into Star Wars, or you just don't like the idea of like fantastical engineering, I think trying like all that infrastructure engineering and like all the weirs and everything that you managed to get into the Scarif board, I think is would like I would like encourage anybody to have like a look at it, because I think sort of like the especially sort of like the water effects and like the churning water that you've got to get over those weirs looks, you know, it's just like shooting quality sort of like modeling. It almost looks like a thing that's going to be filmed, because it just looks, it's like mind-bogglingly cool with how you sort of actually manage to make all that the water, especially I think, like, would you agree that really on like the whole board, it's like it's the water effects which is sort of doing a lot of the heavy lifting for a lot, because there's water moving in so many different locations and so many different directions, and you know, you've got flowing water, churning water, cascading water.
It really is. It really is. It's about the water. It's about the tower. And basically, the water does the heavy lifting, because again, the scenery and the way they shot it for the movie is you know, I don't know. I haven't been lucky enough to go to the Maldives to find out whether the sea is genuinely that blue. So they might have filters, but it is an absolutely gorgeous visual that I'm attempting to replicate, and certainly for the board, it is strikingly blue when you come over and have a look at it, and so on. And yes, there's a lot of thought kind of gone into, right, so the water has got to be moving, it's kind of coming in, so how do I get the waves so that they're all in a consistent piece? And then so there's then water kind of coming down here, and there's going to be channels, and we've got a lead up to a weir. So then we've got to put races in that shows the water is suddenly going from being sluggish or tide driven to being suddenly quite rapid as it's being sucked towards these weir waterfalls. And then obviously down actually within the reservoir around the base of the tower, you've got these massive cascading waterfalls, and the water is spinning out and crashing off various different walls and shapes and so on. And how's it reverberating, and where's it being pulled and sucked, and where else do I kind of put the foaming on? And it's all about the water, because the land is kind of uniformly flat. It's just a little bit of sandy beach, and then trees and so on. So the key was getting the water right, and I, actually it was surprisingly straightforward. I just used there's a guy doing the model railways, a guy called Mark Lynn of Sweden. I doubt he invented the process, but that was how I found him on YouTube. And it's just toilet paper put on in layers with a really diluted PVA mix, and you just use a 1.5 or a 2-inch paintbrush, a decorating paintbrush. And you just tap the pattern out of the loo paper, and you put maybe two or three layers of loo paper down, and you just dilute, drench it in the liquid PVA. You just tap out the pattern, and then you just use the brush to just ruche up various little wave lines. So I just created wave lines just by gently prodding the loo paper and pushing it all in one direction in order to kind of create a wave. And you know, I just created hundreds of waves as you're kind of going all the way around the board, and you just leave it to dry, and when it dries, it dries hard, and then It was taster pots from the local DIY store, various shades of blue, and then it's just starting at the islands, work one colour in for a short distance, then blend it with the next colour, and then put the next colour on, and then blend that so that you ended up with about eight or so different shades of blue that are kind of all merging in, and then ensuring that the deepest, most vibrant blue is covering as much of the deepest areas and as much of the board as it possibly can, because that's the color that is, is really, really visually appealing. And then just adding in a little bit of greenery before, I think I let it dry for about 7 days. I think I really let it dry before I applied the varnish, because the last thing I wanted was for the varnish to go on top of anything that was wet. So I think I was really, really nervous at that point, is because if the first layer of varnish had gone on and gone cloudy white, I was pretty much stuffed.
With I suppose that's a point to ask. Like, when you're doing something like those, something like your boards, how do you approach sort of like drying times and that? Do you sort of like keep a note of, right, that bit was done on Tuesday, so it'll be ready on Thursday? Or do you just sort of like wait until you finish the whole thing and go, right, I'm now going to give the whole thing a week to dry?
I tend to do the whole thing, in one section, but it'll take days to do certain things. But yes, I will tend to do all of one thing and move on as a whole, simply because that there's I really want the joints and the boards to be as invisible as possible. And you kind of got to do everything before you move on to the next piece, where you've got the joints that you're kind of doing like that. So with that one, I actually glued the toilet paper over the joins. So what I did was put the board out full, as one piece, everything together, and then I put the toilet paper across the entire board, and waited for it to dry. And then I've got a knife blade that is kind of in the shape of a hook, and what that kind of allows me to do is to cut whilst going away from me. So most of the time when you're cutting, you're drawing the knife towards you. Whereas what I could do with this was stand, perpend, well, sorry, in line with the two baseboards. I could get my knife blade in between two boards that were right next to each other, and then I could lift it up and then gradually drag it away from me. And that allowed me then to cut through the toilet paper in one cut. So rather than doing each board individually, I'd actually created, there's in theory a knife blade difference between the two sides. It doesn't quite work that way because your boards warp a little bit, and you can never quite get them back in the way that you had them laid out, but it's still very close. But it was,
Yeah, I would imagine like the waves that you make are going to line up 1,000% better than if you just put them both on the board edge and try to match them up by eye.
absolutely, yes. And that's the key. The real trick was, you can't paint all of one colour for the sea on the board, because the board itself is probably, is only 1.5 meters long, and some of the islands are 1.5 meters long. But there's about 30 of them, and you know, when you add up the coastline, there's probably 30 meters of coast. So you can't put one color on all the way around the board and then work to the next color and try and blend it in. You have to blend whilst they're all wet. So it was working in sections, and then, you know, at the end of the day, I was having to come back the following day, and everything's kind of dried, and then you have to start blending everything in again over the bit that you painted yesterday that dried. And it's dreadfully tedious. Some of these things that they kind of do, because that they take quite a lot of time, and it's dreadfully tedious. But at this point, I have to say an enormous thank you to you, because I was listening to your podcast and to several other podcasts all the way kind of through that. And whilst you're doing all of this really tedious kind of stuff, it's absolutely brilliant to be able to listen to something that's engaging, because you can go for so much longer than you could at any other time.
I was doing some rather tedious painting the other day, and I was listening to an audiobook, and halfway through my painting I was like, do you know what, I think I'm going to have to start sourcing out an audiobook on like the corn laws. And I was like, I need to do some more fun painting. I need to do more interesting painting. If I'm not going to go to corn laws, that's interesting. but I think it's one of those things where, like, I love building terrain. Like, I don't build terrain, obviously, like you do. But I think quite a lot of it is just very much process driven, isn't it? It's just, I'm doing this. Like the biggest terrain thing I did this year was, like, I spent a month building forests. But it's just like, I'm going to just do the same thing over and over and over again for, like, you know, I'm going to be here for like 6 hours and just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, and then wait several days for it to dry, and then do the same thing over and over again. Like, I truly take my hat off to you for being able to do that for what must be, like, rather than just like, I've got to do this for a few days. It's like, no, I've got to do this for several weeks. And because, like, how long, like, did, like do you keep a track of, like, roughly how many hours go into your boards? Or is it something that you just think would be like a doom pit to sort of do?
Yeah, I think it would be a doom pit if I worked it out. If I understood how much time would go in at the beginning, then I think sometimes you kind of balk at it. I tend not to, but you know, I have a very understanding wife who understands my need for solitude and kind of doing strange things. So that's quite good. And you know, I've got two boys that are old enough now to be able to mind their own business and keep themselves entertained without requiring much input from me. So it's kind of okay. And I think the thing is I get quite a reward from seeing a phase finish. It's not like I'm actually doing the same thing for weeks on end. Even the tedious tasks are probably just maybe three or four afternoons worth of work. So it kind of, you can see an end to it even when you're kind of starting and you're kind of getting discouraged. And once you actually get that little bit of progress, and adding the paint to the seas, that it started to look, the board started to look like it was going to be something. So the paint was an enormous step forward, and I knew at that point it was going to work. You know, I was pretty confident before I went into it because I wouldn't be, but I really knew as soon as I got the sea colours in and I was happy, I knew it was going to work. And so that was a big thing. That's kind of going to work. And that then kind of acts then as the spur for, well, right, let's get on and kind of do the other things. And as soon as, you know, I've kind of done the sea, then I could start putting in all of the infrastructure that kind of existed. So, you know, Scariff is crisscrossed with all kinds of what I refer to as kind of transit lines. And in theory, you know, again, the background research kind of really helps because you're kind of looking at it and you could see a lot of, as you were saying earlier, there is a lot of background that kind of goes into these things. But people in the movie have decided, right, well, we need something, but why is it there? What would be there as well? What kind of other things in? So there's all of these kind of concept diagrams and stills, and they've even put some of the kind of the storyboarding images that they were creating in the early CGI phases. So you can kind of see how it was all kind of layered up from a CGI point of view. And the crazy thing is that Scariff doesn't exist in any way, shape or form, except as a CGI. They might have shot individual shots of people on the ground in places in the Maldives, but none of the aerial shots of the movie are of anywhere real or anywhere close to real, because I've seen the CGI rendering of all of these atolls and islands that they've kind of done. And it's as soon as I kind of got that kind of base kind of piece done, I knew I was on to a winner. The other thing I should say is there's a distinctive look to the sand on the beaches on Scariff, and I had to source a really, really obscure paint in order to get my sand the perfect colour. It took ages to kind of find, but there's this unusual paint, Leyland Trade Magnolia. Apparently, I mean, it's obscure, but you can get it in tubs of 15 litres. I didn't need anywhere near that much, but that turns out that obscure paint is the perfect colour for the beaches in Scariff. And another shout out to Dan Hodgson to say thank you very much, because he actually managed to visit the Maldives, and he was able to confirm that I'd got the right colour for the beaches. So that was really pleasing. So I think the key takeaway from all of this is you can do marvelous things with readily available and very cheap paints.
Well, I think it's one of the things that, like, I hope that, like, our podcast sort of promotes and champions a little bit, is the fact that, like, especially I think with terrain building of anything, I mean, you can come up with genuine works of art by performing, like, a series of, like, some of them are quite complicated but still relatively simple, although it's not more like a number of individual processes which come together to perform, like, create absolutely amazing works of art. I think it's quite similar to sort of, I would say it's maybe similar to sort of like tapestry. It's like you do like one or two stitches, you learn how to do those, you can then make a tapestry. You're just doing it like a thing at a time. And I think, especially with like YouTube channels and that sort of thing, and you can like, oh, how do I do this? Right, I want to do this. And then coming up with an idea and then go like approaching it, go, right, how do I do this? Right, this person shows me how to do this. How do I do this, 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 and this? How you sort of go. And yeah, especially something like the stuff that those modern railway people make is sort of mind-bogglingly.
I think it's absolutely spot on. I'm an absolute sponge for cool ideas. I watch the YouTube stuff. I look at lots of stuff online. I read other kind of people's blogs, and all the time I'm kind of going, "Oh, that would be really cool. Oh, that would be really cool." And I'm really lucky that I've got the kind of a memory that's able to go, I've seen some, I saw something about that. I can use that for this. And that kind of happened with the Scariff board, is that I think at one point I was thinking about doing one of the SAS raids in the desert as a game. And so I'd started looking at various things. And one of the things I'd been looking for was trees, the palm trees that you get in the northern desert. It's probably the wrong phrase, palm tree, but the kind of the trees that you get in the desert. And again, I'm always working at all of my stuff seems to be done at the really small scale. So I'm not doing anything in true scale 1 to 300. I'm always doing it on some kind of a ground scale. So I'm always looking not for 1 to 300 trees or anything like that. I'm kind of looking for 1 to 600, 1 to 900 kind of trees. And I came across a guy who discovered a way of making these palm trees really, really cheaply and effectively. And you know, what he'd done is he'd taken a pinhead nail, he'd put some textured paint up the on the nail, he stuck them into a piece of polystyrene, then he put a blob of PVA on the top, and then he sprinkled 4 or 6 millimeter static grass of various blended shades, and he just sprinkled that on top. And basically, he could create about 600 or 800 trees in an afternoon. And, you know, they look absolutely fantastic for the kind of scale. You know, when you look at them individually, you're kind of going, oh, that's some static grass on top of a pin. But, you know, when you've got 800 on a table, you know, don't look at an individual tree. You're going for the effect. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. And then I started thinking, right, well, how am I going to do my trees for my Scariff board? And I thought, oh, I'll go back and do that. But I had a look, and the, you know, the static grass didn't kind of work, because it was just a different type of tree for North Africa with the overhanging thing, and the kind of the much more voluminous kind of trees, the coconut or the palms that you have in the Maldives. And okay, you know, I'm kind of thinking, right, no, that's not going to work. And I tried a couple other things. I really did. I had a look at, I got hold of some pine, Christmas tree pine fronds, that these are just the paper that's wrapped around a wire. And I started cutting those up and shaping them and things like that. But it didn't look right. And then I was getting really, really desperate, because there was only about 4 or 5 weeks left to go. And the only thing I had left to do were all of these trees. But I needed some trees. And then I started thinking, right, well, what if I got some of the coarse foam that Woodland Scenic do and just kind of glued that on top of the nails? And so it was kind of, I tried that. Didn't quite work out. But then I realised that I got some of their foliage. And Woodland Scenics do this marvellous product, which is called Foliage. And it's kind of on a nylon net, but it's kind of foam that's either woven or they weave the kind of the very, very thin nylon. You can barely tell that it's kind of there. Maybe it's polyester, I'm not sure. And what I discovered is that if I took these and effectively they come as a kind of a sheet, and the foam drops off it if all over the place, you end up with a big trail of little pieces of foam wherever you go. But if I cut a little bit off and then squeezed the lighter coloured one into a little disc and put super glue on the top of my pin, my pin head nail, then the whole thing melted on top of the nail and got really good adhesion. And then if I cut a darker colour, and I alternated between the kind of the medium and the dark green, and then I kind of scrunched that into a little triangular shape. And again, you know, we're only talking about something that's about 5 or 6 mil in any dimension, and then glued that on top of the other one, then it kind of looked like I had kind of dying or sunlight starved leaves on the underside, and you had this kind of sprouting darker leaves on top. And I found I could create 100 trees in about 90 minutes, which was fantastic. And it again, when you look at them individually, you can get up right close and go, oh yeah, that's just a couple of pieces of foam glued on top of a nail. But when you look at it from a distance, and I chose a really small island, did about 5 or 6 of them and stuck them on and stuck some undergrowth underneath and in between them, and I went, okay, and I just stood about a couple of feet back and went, right, okay, yeah, that's going to work. So I went into full production mode, and then this is you know, I think we were talking on the Hangout last night about how you guys think I'm mad, and everybody was quite nice and said, no, you're not. I started to realise just quite how mad I was, because I thought, right, this isn't so bad. I'm going to need about 800, 1,000 trees, no problem. That's fine. So I started the production, and you know, again, 90 minutes, I can produce 100 of these. So I did it for a couple of days, and I got 400 of them. And I thought, right, I'll go and stick them in, make sure I still like it, and you know, I'll get a bit of a better idea about how many I need. So I went and got bored, and I worked on a section, and I stuck all 400 of my trees in. And then I thought, oh crikey, I might be in a bit of trouble here, because I'm not going to need 400, I'm going to need 1200. So I went home, and then I started doing it after everybody else in the family had gone to bed at night, and putting in another hour or something, and I got another 400 done in a couple of days and came back. And then I spent another couple of hours gluing them into my board, and then I realised that I didn't need 1200, I needed 1600. And I started to get that sinking feeling that maybe 1600 wouldn't be enough. So I went and did more, and then I did more, and then I did more, and then I did all of the nails, and I ended up going back and buying, you buy them by weight, and I ended up buying refills twice. And I ended up doing 2,000, just over 2,000 trees on the table, and I could easily have stuck another 200 or 300 on there. I just, as I was running out of time, and I think I glued the last one in on the night before the first show, it was kind of getting to the point, yes, this is how many trees I've got, so this is what's going to have to do. At that point even I was questioning my dedication to
they look astounding in that they look like, I thought the first time I saw them, I thought you 3D printed them, because they truly do not look like, you have to get really close to see that, you know, like very close to see that they aren't proper, yes, little trees. And like, yeah, you're like, it's the whole thing with I think, like, even like 6 mil gaming in general, you never look close at the thing. you look at it from a distance. And like I say, you know, if you're working on like a 1 to 6, like a 1 to 900 scale, instead, it's even like it's orders of magnitude smaller. So the idea is, it's not like look at it from like 3 feet away. Look at it from like 10 feet away.
Exactly, and I think that's exactly what you've got to do. The thing I'm going for is kind of that large scale, as you say, the large scale diorama. Is Scarif, like Ingen, is meant to be viewed stood 5 or 6 feet away, where you're taking in a big view, and you know, we see the dioramas all the time that the guys do, that they're exquisite in the level of detail, and they've gone in and you can see drain pipes that are there, and you know, they've cut them off and they've broken them, and there's rust and then there's drips and everything else, and they've kind of gone down into that kind of fine scale detail, which is absolutely gorgeous and wonderful stuff. But I'm not quite going for that look. I'm going for the table and for people to be able to kind of drink in the entire view of something, rather than having to get up close and look at minute details. And yeah, that's the piece, and they hold up. The trees hold up really, really well when you look at them from anything other than really close range. I was absolutely delighted when it went in, because it was the cherry on top of the cake. It was the last piece, and you know, the other solutions that I came up, and I looked at 3D printing. It's just all of the palm trees that you got when 3D printing would came in multiple pieces. I hadn't got a printer, and then I was starting to think, well, not only am I going to have to do that, then I'm going to have to glue them all together. And then once I've glued them all together, then I'm going to have to paint them. And then everybody that's doing 6mm palm trees is actually doing them for true scale 6mm. So I'd have to shrink them all down, and then they're not going to stick all together. And I looked at all kind of crazy things. I even looked at, I think Green Stuff will do some plants out of paper that you can kind of get. And you know, they're intended for 28mm, so that you kind of get these 5 or 6 really big leaves that kind of look like ferns that you kind of get and you kind of curl together. But what I noticed was that there were all of these little curl, all of these little edges and kind of pieces like a, I can't remember what it's called, but you know, the infinite design.
Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of goes. And I started cutting those off. And my first prototype was actually one of those things where I glued 7 of these little pieces that I'd snipped off with a knife on top of a pin, and it actually looked like a really, really good palm tree. I mean, it was green instead of the browns or whatever that you really needed, and it looked absolutely fantastic. The only problem was I could get about 10 trees per sheet of this green paper stuff. It took 5 minutes to stick together. They kept falling off, and each sheet from Green Stuff cost something like £5 or £7. And so it was just monstrously expensive. Whereas I did my 2000 trees for probably about £30. And that includes like 2000 nails. And I think I went through about 3 packs of the foliage stuff, you know, so all together in the glue. And, yeah, just be really careful. I don't want anybody to think that I am endorsing sitting there with super glue out in front of you, but I do appear to have a remarkable tolerance for super glue fumes. I did not come out in a rash, and as far as I'm aware, I was not tripping at any point during my sessions.
I enjoy when you're doing super glue and clump foliage, how like just periodically it reacts with just some random bits of it. So when you sort of got like I don't know if you had this with your palm trees, but I know like when I was building my forest, just like have you like a desk full of them, and then just be like a couple of them sort of like gently smoldering away, and one way sort of like turning to a small pile of goo, and it's like, yep. Well, they can have a bit more clump foliage on there. But I found out bizarrely, because I've always used like the Woodland Scenics clump foliage, like relatively sparingly because it's quite expensive for the shakers, and I was buying like the big bags of like random stuff from eBay. But I, when I was building my forests, I actually like ran out. I depleted one guy's stock on eBay, and then like he sent me the. He said, "I've got none left. I haven't got any more." Like, right, let me know when you've got some more. He got some more, and it was completely different. So I, and then he stopped selling it big. Anyway, I ended up buying some of the Woodland Scenics instead, which was more expensive. But I just found it went so much further. It was just it actually. Oh, this is twice the price, but goes like five times further.
Yes, absolutely. I've got all kinds of the various stuff, and you know, like you, I'm doing the same with my woods and my fields and whatever. And I am not. I'm not making a dent in it. I've got it in all of these little plastic jars. So each one, I kind of decant and put in all of these little jars, and I've kind of got them up there, and then I get them out. But I've wedged so much in each of these jars because the volume and so that I kind of do all of this, and I've produced 30 or 40 fields, and I've done 20 or 40 woodlands and whatever, and yet I haven't made a dent. It was a surprise when I started running out of the foliage, and that was one of those kind of moments that you have when you know that fate has decreed that you will build this board, because I was sat there at the dining room table just before tea, kind of putting one of these things together, and I kind of got to the end, and I had about a centimeter and a half square of this light foliage left, and I'm sat there kind of just finishing it up, and I was kind of like, okay, right, it's fine. And then dropped through the door this little parcel and kind of went over, picked it up. And literally that was the moment that the order that I'd put in about 3 or 4 days earlier arrived. And it was literally exactly the right time for it to arrive. And it was kind of like, okay, yeah, this is it. I know I'm supposed to build this now.
It's the stockpiling supplies, isn't it? It's or especially when you go to a shop and you order, I want like 15 of those, please. It's like the person's looking at it like, why on earth do you need like 15 A4 size scouring pads?
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't believe me if I told you, so we'll just leave it a mystery.
Well, the missus keeps going, what have you ordered now? Have you not got enough yet? And that one was like, No. This is literally. It is the entire stock thing is being done on time needed. There is no storage. It is literally coming in, and I'm using it up. And it's kind of like no. I know I've ordered all of this stuff, but it's replacing stuff I've already used.
Door to workbench delivery system.
Yeah. Well, it was, they call it, is it just in time stock management in industry, don't they? So, yeah, it literally was. I was doing just in time store management of my flock and so on.
It's one of the joys of the hobby, though, isn't it? When you realize, like, I like flock collecting and like paint collecting. And also say, I was like really pleased the other day that I'd got a new like red brick paint set turned up. I was like, yes. And I was like, it's slightly cretinous to go, I'm really excited. And I got, I'm painting some buildings. I'll just get that paint set out. Away I go. But you can never find the right thing, can you? It's the same as like static grass. You'll have like 27 tubs of static grass. It's like, I need some of that, like, that's too short and that's too long. I need the 3 mil static grass, the 4 won't cut it, and the 2 is like dust. So, run out of?
So when I was kind of doing Scarif, so obviously the trees went on last, but what I did before they did the trees is I was working with all different kinds of tufts. And basically all I did was I just got every single tuft that I had accumulated over like the last 10 years and got them all out. And it worked out, I think, that I had something like 20 different kinds of tuft. And then I would just drop them in randomly, never the same one next to the next one. And I just worked through all of these sheets of tufts just kind of really varying the piece. And so there's kind of an underlayer below all of the trees of all of these various kinds of things. And, you know, it's crazy stuff. Somebody very briefly did nettles. So there are nettles in there. There are bulrushes in there. There are daffodils in there. And again, you're just repurposing all of these kind of things. And then there's just the boring 2 millimeter and the 6 millimeter and the 8 millimeter static grass. And I got all of these static sheets that had kind of been done and cut some of those up. And then there are crop strips and they got cut up. So all of this kind of stuff is just kind of going on, and you're just riffing on a theme. It was fantastic. Great.
It's a great thing of playing about with scales, though, tough, isn't it? Because, like, oh, that in like what for like a 28 mil guy, that's like a dandy, like that's like a tougher cow grass. For your smaller scale dudes, are they bulrushes? It's exactly the same tuft, you know. It's just
exactly, and it's great because it's kind of like this is an alien world. It can be whatever I call it.
Yeah, I can have daffodils that are, you know, higher than the figures of the
exactly, and so
triffids.
Yes, and you know, it just provides that variance of color. And again, when if people get up really really close, you can kind of look at it and go, oh, that's kind of strange. But actually, again, when you take that step back, actually just blend into the background, but actually it's just a real difference of color, and it's just subtle and it's kind of there. So
it's something that like professional model makers do all the time, because I think I told you, like, I think especially like the landscape, like the islands and like all the water, and that I think it is like a filming quality sort of model. It's the sort of thing that, you know, if they're making Rogue One in the 80s, it's the sort of thing that they'd probably like actually like had the cameras around to sort of film. But I know like the big models, like spaceships and like all those sort of things, quite often like the model builders, when they used to build those, would just cover them in like random bits of doodads and whatever they've got knocking about in the offcut box, just to like break it up a bit and go, what is it? It's just a bit of random.
I watched a video where Adam Savage, he was ex of MythBusters, but he's got a YouTube series called Tested Now, and he was one of the model makers that they used on the prequel series for Star Wars. So a lot of his kind of contacts and movie experience, and you know, obviously he's an incredibly creative guy, and he did a 45 minute video which just talked about, how do you create a spaceship? And he didn't even do the whole spaceship. But what he did was he said, like, let's create a wing. And he just over 45 minutes just showed how you kind of built the wing. And so, you know, he cut it out to styrene and he did a shape. And he says, you've got to kind of do that. And then he says, yeah, but then you've got to put a notch in it, or you've got to change the shape so it's not a standard triangle. And he said, but that's actually still really boring. So what you kind of got to do is you've got to create some kind of interest in it. And then the eye doesn't really see that, but it sees that there's something there, and it fills in for the brain. And the brain kind of assumes, oh, right, and everything else is kind of there. So then you get thinner bits of styrene and you kind of stick that on. And then, you know, he says, right, so what you do, rounded corners, or you do this, or you do kind of sharp angles, and then you do infills, and then you put one in-cut opposite another in-cut, and then you put something else on. And he says, and then you go and get your half finished model or part piece or rejected model kit, and you just pull something out that's interesting, and then you stick it on. And so it's what are known in the industry as greeblies. And again, you know, they just take wheels or various bits and pieces and kind of do that. And that's exactly what I did with the tower and the other bits. So The tower itself kind of has two wings that are attached on the bottom and on the side, and they're enormous things, and they're kind of huge, and they stretch back, and they kind of go to a kind of a point, and then there's another piece, a kind of another wing that sticks out even further, and on the end of that there's an antenna. And nobody's spotted it yet, but my antennas are actually the barrels of some NG-42s.
That's very fitting for Star Wars.
It is. It's exactly that. I mean, you know, they were using Stirlings, is it, for the Stormtrooper guns, and you know, that they do all of that kind of thing. And so I did that, and then, you know, once I'd kind of built my tower and I'd built my base, then obviously I've got all of Adam Savage's kind of ideas buzzing around in my head. So you know, I cut lots of styrene sheet or plastic card sheet, and kind of arrange that, and again in shapes. And various bits and pieces. So in one of them, you've kind of got trapezoids with inverted trapezoids alternating as it kind of goes around the base of the tower, and it kind of creates a detail that's kind of in there. And then you kind of put the U-shaped styrene strips around that kind of indicates that there's a level change. And then for the actual bits of the tower itself, I kind of scored, rather than kind of cutting through. What I did was I created it out of foam board first, but then I cut a plastic card sheet, but I scored all of the various panels. So I spent a lot of time looking at these various images, and I was really lucky because there was a diorama kind of convention that used to run in the States every year. I think in 2018 or 2019, the theme was Rogue One. And what they'd done is they'd created a gallery of 200 images from the movie. And I literally went and downloaded every single one and started putting them on a carousel. So I was always looking at them when I was home. And then you start sifting and copying the images. So, right, if I want an image of the tower, I've got all of these. If I want an image of the woods or the trees, then they're all here. So I kind of did all of that. So I spent a lot of time kind of looking at these images and kind of cutting all of these shapes and kind of scoring it all and kind of doing it, and then putting that on top of the plastic card. And then you're kind of doing a lot of stuff with mathematics. Building the tower was kind of it sounds insane, but that there's a kind of like a mathematical logic to kind of how the tower is created. So I got the map, which showed me the kind of the overall layout, and I knew how big I kind of wanted that to be. The map kind of gave me the scale, and I kind of knew. And so it turns out that the base of the tower, when I kind of did my map, was roughly one third of the size of the table. So that's great. I now know that my base of my tower fit onto 1 2-foot wide terrain board. So as soon as I've got my 2 foot wide terrain board, I kind of know what my measurements are. So that gives me my outer dimension of the base. And then I calculated everything else and did that and kind of cut all of that. And again, there's a mathematical precision to it. As you say, the base of the tower, when viewed from the top, and you take away the actual Citadel tower itself, but the base is actually laid out exactly kind of like the imperial symbol from Star Wars, and it's a very clever way that the movie people kind of did it. But by kind of doing that, you know that there are angles and you can measure the angles. So I got up images and printed out images of that imperial symbol, and I started using a protractor to get the angles and various things like that. So that then told me how I lay it out and what angles I needed to cut and how I needed to do it. So I started to get an idea about how big everything else was. And then once I've done that, then okay, now I've got my base of my tower. I now know how deep my tower is going to be because I can see where it ends in the movie. So if I measure that, that gives me the bottom of my tower. But you don't know what anything else is. You don't know how high it is. And unfortunately, Lucasfilm hadn't released any technical specs, and I couldn't find anywhere online that anybody had actually put any of the dimensions. So I had no idea how big the tower was. But, and again, it's going to sound a bit silly, but the golden ratio. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah, it's an architectural thing.
Absolutely, it's an architectural thing. So as soon as I got one number, I knew how to calculate all the other variables in it. So I knew that my base of my tower was, or the base of the wing was 15 centimetres, because that's just what it worked out as. It worked out at 15 centimetres. And I kind of knew what angle it kind of came off. So when I did that and I got to an angle that was visually pleasing for the kind of the thing, then I could take that measurement. Once I got that measurement, I could apply the golden ratio, and that told me how high that piece of thing needed to be. So I could do that. And then once I got that, then I had a baseline to do the bottom part of the tower. And again, by starting again with the golden ratio on there, I knew how tall the top part of my tower was. So I knew what that was going to be. And then you could just then start filling in everything else. And then it all started just with that one single measurement, which was determined by the size of my baseboards. And so I don't have kind of all of the things, but I spent time kind of calculating how big all of these various things were kind of going to be, just because if you don't get the tower right, it kind of looks like Scaris, but not quite.
Yeah, so I think that sounds like a very complex bit of mental gymnastics, but actually I think it sounds very similar to when we had a chat before and you said how you would, I think it was with the Arnhem board, where you were working out the sizes of some of the bridge, where you'd be like working out sizes from like when you've got like one image and you go, well, I know how big X is, I can now work out Y, Z and everything else from there. And I think it makes perfect sense to sort of me. They're going, you've got here, how you can sort of go from there. It just probably means, I guess that was like a couple of hours, like, or many days, so like drawing up like the architectural diagrams for it. So figure, today I'm being an architect. So like working out the plans for it with the calculator and the protractor and that. But I guess you'd have, if you didn't do that beforehand, you'd just be in a nightmare. It wouldn't work, would you? I think if you were trying to sort of like do it by eye.
I don't think I ever drew up the full plans, because I'm not very good artistically at drawing, so I never drew up the kind of the full plans. But basically, what I kind of worked out was, well, I can work out what angle I want it to be at. So I know how triangular it is. I know how big the wings are. I'll kind of do that. But now I've kind of got my height, and now I've got to add that other piece on. And some bits I'm going to say I did by eye, but then there were other bits where there was some detailing down the front, and I knew how tall it was. And then I went, oh, right, well, I counted how many panels there were, and I could see that some of the panels were bigger than the others. So I just stepped them up by 0.3 millimetres each time until it got to a point, and then stepped them back down. And you're just kind of playing with some of the kind of the visual bits for it. And I spent absolutely ages doing some of the side detailing and kind of doing that. And again, that was just off kind of the drawings. And then again, because it's foam board, you spend a lot of time just kind of pinning it together to make sure that it kind of works okay, and kind of did little bits and pieces. And then you find out when you actually glued it together, you didn't get one thing quite the right height, so you have to cut one side because it looks a little lopsided, and you're kind of doing that and just filling in some of the gaps and things. But it is remarkably straightforward once you've kind of got that kind of principle. Once you've kind of done that, then it kind of guides you through the rest of the piece, and it gives you a bit of confidence that actually it looks visually appealing. Because I'm going to take a punt and say that the guys that did the CGI for it applied exactly the same principle when they did it. Is that they knew how wide the bottom bit was, and that determined, or they knew how tall it was, and that therefore that determined how wide it was. And I'll bet that they used some version of let's go with the golden ratio for kind of doing this, because it looks right on the movie. And so, yeah, it's just one of those little crazy things that you can kind of do, but it kind of works. And so I use it regularly with all the things that I'm doing, is just apply that golden ratio. And it takes so much of the guesswork out of the bits that you're cutting and doing, because, you know, nobody else knows what it is. It's just got to look right.
Well, I think that following any kind of system, I think for when you're building almost anything, I think even if, like, obviously, like, in architecture, the golden ratio is the golden ratio for a reason, because it works intrinsically. And even though nobody's really quite sure why it does, it just sort of does. It just looks right.
Yeah. Yes.
But I think, like, even if, like, you're just, like, following any kind of thing for, like, you know, basing models or anything, or, like, you're building anything, oh, I'm making a load of walls, I'm going to make them 4 millimetres high. Why are you making them 4 millimetres high? Well, it's because it's better than 3 or it's better than 5. And just, like, following that kind of system, just having a kind of system,
yes,
I think just makes, like, so many of these big things that you're trying to do, like, more manageable. Although I'm doing this because this is the reason why I'm doing it.
Yes.
There's not necessarily maybe, like, a greater reasoning behind it, but I think it's just having some of these rules when you're trying to approach some of these things. I do as well. I know, like, quite often when I've not built that many, like, completely freeform buildings, but, like, and I've never built anything like as adventurous as, like, your Scarif Tower, but, like, when I have built things before, yeah, I've always just started with, like, one thing. Or if I'm, like, taking a copy of, like, a picture as something, like, oh, I know that, like, that door frame will be, like, X high, I'll measure that. I'll then, like, work out all my other measurements from the measurement of how big that door is. Like, if I've measured that door and, like, in my head I've decided it's, like, a 7-foot tall door, yeah, in reality it's, like, 5'6" or something, then my building's going to be completely wrong, but it will still actually be in scale to that.
Yeah, I first came across it. I was building the Parthenon with my youngest at the time, and obviously, being who I am, I was massively over engineering it. And we built a precision model of the Parthenon for his year 5 or year 6 class, can't remember which one it is. So he knew more about the Parthenon than anybody else, because, you know, he could reel off all of the pillars, because we put them all in and he painted them and we did all the stuff. But I knew how wide the main door on the Parthenon was, because I got an overhead plan of the Parthenon. So I knew how wide it was, but I didn't know how tall it was. And my mum had videoed or taped or stored or recorded a program talking about Greek architecture, and they were looking at another temple, and then they were explaining in that how important the golden ratio was. And it was kind of like, yeah, it's kind of like the width of a palm versus the length of a palm. It's something really simple. It's something that everybody kind of grasped. And that was the first time I kind of come across it. I think I knew about it from the Alhambra, but that was kind of like, oh, I suddenly know how big my door on this Parthenon's going to be. And it's kind of, yeah. So like I said earlier, you know, I store away all of these little kind of things and then have the ability to kind of go, oh, I know. I'll be able to kind of do that. It's kind of crazy, but yes. But yeah, and so yeah, that kind of got me. So once the kind of the tower was kind of done and so on, then that kind of got me the board. So I've got my sea, I've got my forest, I've got my tower, I've got my base with all of the bits in. I've got my transit lines crisscrossing everywhere, and that's all in place. And then I kind of had a game that I kind of got to come up with, and it's got to be in 6 mil. And then turns out the guy that I bought the Rogue One figures off on the internet may never actually have produced them at all, and they never arrived. And so with a couple of months to go, I'm tasked with sourcing 6 millimeter stormtroopers and various other kinds of bits and pieces and all the various paraphernalia. So I end up finding somebody that's produced legally distinct stormtroopers. Had to order them off Shapeways, which cost me an arm and a leg. It cost me another arm and a leg when I realized I'd only ordered half as many as I actually needed. So I had to order them all again. So that was great. I mean, they're really, really nice figures, but they're tricky to paint. I thought it was going to be fine. I thought, yeah, I'll just paint these white and then put an ink wash on, and that'll do all the black inlay on the Stormtrooper. Oh, no, because the black ink wash.
You just end up with then like Death Troopers.
Yeah, well, I think in what is it, Solo? They're doing siege warfare or some warfare on a mud planet, and everybody's covered in mud. So when I did the ink wash all over those figures, yes, they came out grey, and it was kind of like, oh right, okay, so. I kind of had to get the thinnest brush I could find, and then I had to fine line the junction on Stormtrooper armor, and then the helmets. It's you don't realize until you start painting Stormtrooper helmets how burned in your mind the image of a Stormtrooper is, because you couldn't recreate it if you tried to just by drawing it.
But you know if it's slightly wrong when you see it.
You know it's wrong when you don't get it right. And so I think I have two stands of Stormtroopers that I kind of accumulated the best ones I'd done, so that if anybody said, can I have a quick look at your figures, I would have a stand of Stormtroopers that I could put up and somebody could look at a couple of inches away and go, oh, right, they're brilliant, they are, and then assume that the rest of them on the table are the same quality. But it is really, really difficult. They've kind of like got a moustache over the mouth. They've got eyes that are actually arcs or kind of pieces. There's other elements that are kind of on there, and my Stormtroopers look really, really good when they're looked at from the rear, because you know they look like proper Stormtroopers. You can see the shape of the helmet, you can see the black at the junction of the Stormtrooper armor. but it's kind of, when you look at the faces, it's kind of a bit tricky.
I would imagine that a lot of that's also going to be in, like, even in like the greatest, absolute greatest sculpts in the world, because so much of that is like detail. And as you said, they're like snouty kind of nose, the lenses, that sort of stuff. It would be really difficult to get that on like 10 mil dudes, wouldn't it? Yet alone sixes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Glad you've got a face, lads.
This is it. I mean, yeah, I look at them when you see the 28 mil stuff and that people do for Legion and so on, and that's kind of fine. They get some absolutely gorgeous stormtroopers, but yes, I found it really, really difficult. 6 mil. The shore troopers, on the other hand, were fairly straightforward, because they were exactly the same figure. It's just the shore troopers just have a single black kind of piece across the eyes, and it's just kind of straight over. But you know, and again, you know, don't tell anybody, but it's six millimeters. You can't tell, not until somebody points it out. So they're just the same figure painted differently, with a kind of a broader dash where the eyes would be, in order to represent that shape on the helmet. And you know, that they look the business. You just add a little bit of detailing and it's absolutely fine. So that got me all of my or pretty much most of my Imperials. So what I then needed was some Rebel Commandos, and I kind of looked at some of the Vietnam figures, because you know, when you look at the movie stills and the images that they use for continuity, that you know, that
it really, well, like Rogue One is kind of like it's a halfway house, like it's a Star Wars movie that's also very much like a Vietnam / sort of World War II movie.
Yes,
it's kind of like it's a World War II movie if it was made by somebody who'd really wanted to make Apocalypse Now. Like, they'd seen some of the bits of Apocalypse Now and was like, we want to make this with less drugs, but set it in Star Wars. I think it's kind of got that vibe. So that I could definitely see why you went for the sort of like look to the Vietnam ones. But did you have luck there, or did you have to sort of cast further afield?
I looked, but the only ones I could really find were the GHQ figures, and they didn't match up with my stormtroopers, which were chunkier. So I was casting around, and then Brigade Models, who do absolutely fabulous small scale buildings that I use to make Arnhem, they have a 6 millimeter sci-fi range called Hammers Slammers, and they've got about 10 or so different factions, I think it's kind of a strange future world thing. So there's a Polish faction, I think there's a European faction, there's several others. I'm not really up on it, but I kind of spent a lot of time looking at forums trying to find options for all of this, and then that was kind of looking at all of these different sci-fi ranges. And I found that one of their factions, and I think it's the Poles, looked pretty good for my Rebel Commandos. They kind of had stuff bulging on helmets, and they seemed to be holding kind of guns and so on. So I ordered some of those. And, you know, pleasingly, they were £3 a pack. They were very cheap, and I didn't need that many of them. And then I found another of their factions, again, I think made up faction of the Vitruvians, maybe. They looked bob on for my Death Troopers, because they were just all in helmets and all in armor. And That is the that was the first time I've ever tried a speed paint, a contrast paint. So I painted the Death Troopers with a dark grey slash black, and I then put a gloss varnish on them, and they came out. I'm really pleased with those. They look the absolute business for the Death Troopers. So that was great. I've got my ground forces. That was sorted. So then I needed the at ACTs, the all-terrain armored cargo transports. And again, so if you've seen the movie, you know that they make a very brief and scary and marvelous appearance in the battle. So I definitely wanted to have those available. So I cast around in the marvelous world of Star Wars minis and ordered, I think, three or four different types of AT-ACTs. Each of which will set you back a tenner or maybe more. And Mrs. doesn't know about this yet, and thank God she doesn't listen to your podcast. because, yeah, I blew 40 quid just on prototypes just to see which ones were kind of the right scale. And it turns out that Hot Wheels, which do two versions, but the smaller scale of the Hot Wheels AT-ACTs are absolutely, absolutely brilliant. And they it's great. They do two versions. They do one with a cargo container in, and they do a version with the cargo container missing. So it's kind of like a hollow body of the AT-AT, which is great. So yes, then I ordered five of those. And you know, when the missus was asking, if you, what are you ordering now, that was definitely one of those. Nothing to see here, dear, it's just some minor hobby supplies to replace some things. And so, right, okay, great, I've got that, but if I've got the ACTs, then I'm gonna need X-wings, because the X-wings attack the ACTs. And about 25, 20, 30 years ago at some point, Wizards of the Coast produced a game called Starship Battles, which was when they briefly held the rights for the Star Wars role-playing game. They also came out with a mini game. And it was a less complicated X-Wing, but they produced an entire range all the way up to the Executor, Super Star Destroyer, and the Star Destroyers and things. And some time ago, I'd actually run a Star Wars role-playing game. So I had a bunch of these things in the attic that I hadn't let the missus throw out. So I went upstairs into the loft to the secret point where I store the Star Wars mini, so she can't throw them out when I'm not looking. And pulled out some of my Star Wars figures, and I got TIE fighters, but I hadn't got enough X-Wings. I went and I ordered about another four X-Wings. And again, they're pricey, considering that they're kind of made out of some kind of flexible rubber, and all of the laser guns on the end of the wings all curl in and stuff like that, and you can't straighten them out. And I know, because I've tried. So I got some of those, and then I ordered a Y-wing because I needed one of those, because there's a Y-wing involved. And then I realised that there's a U-wing, and then actually I need a Rogue One. So back to the Hot Wheels people. So the Hot Wheels people did a Rogue One set, but they never released the Rogue One set in the UK. But there are, quite helpfully, some distributors that must have ordered bulk amounts of this stuff from the States. And so there's a guy on eBay, there's maybe a couple of guys on eBay, and you can go on there and he's got a list of about 40 different models, and he must have hundreds of them stacked on a shelf somewhere. And then you can pay him exorbitant amounts of money and you can get a U-Wing, three Rogue Ones, because there's Rogue One and there's a couple other on the landing pad in the stills photos, so those need replacing. And then, of course, Director Krennic needs his ship, and that's only £20. So you then find out that you've just spent another £100 on models. And again, those are that's completely deniable. That did not happen, Ruth.
Set dressing.
Yeah, Ruth, if you're listening, that did not happen. And so, yeah, that's great. So I've got all of that. And then, you know, so you're kind of like, yeah, this is great. This is fine. This is fantastic. Yeah, I've got the whole thing. And then you're going, yeah, but there's a space battle. I haven't quite got everything. I need a space battle. So then I start thinking, right, okay, if I can get some kind of structure, I can build it on top of the table, and then you can get these Perspex sheets, and you can get the sky blue ones. And that could be the planetary shield. And then on top of that, I can put another thing which would be black, and that could be space. And then rummage around. Oh yeah, great. I found some of the spaceships I need for the space battle. So that's great. Okay. Right. Okay. Fantastic. Right, I could do that. But then it turns out that the lighting scaffolding that you'd need for the Perspex is about £250, and it would be quite a job assembling it, and I'd have to get it custom made to the right lengths and stuff, so that didn't work. So I was like, oh right, okay, I can't do that. I don't want it falling over and hurting anyone, and then, you know, I don't want to buy all of this stuff and then have somebody go, you're not putting that up, son. That looks thing. So I was like, right, but it would be really cool if I could get the sky battle and the space battle. And then I'm kind of sat at home trying to figure out how I'm going to do this. And I'm in my little hobby space. And I have, I think they came from Argus, but you can get them from B&Q now. You can get these plastic shelving units, which is basically, it's four black tubes that kind of sit in each corner, and then one tube sits into the shelf, and then you get another one that sits, you can push another kind of tube on top of that, which gives you another one, and you can build these things, and they go up to about 6 feet high. And this is again when you kind of know that these things are kind of done, because I'm sat in the room going, I could use those. And they're really stable, and they're actually quite light. And even if it falls over, then actually it's just some plastic tube that weighs about 100 grams. And even if it falls on a one-year-old, it's not going to be anything other than a thing. And actually, these tubes are about 40 mils in diameter. So actually they're fairly stable. And then if I get this base thing, and then I screw that into the side of my board, and then I can sit this thing in it, I've actually got a pretty stable base. But I still can't put Perspex up. And then I thought, but maybe I could put cloth up. So I kind of started looking for the lightest cloths I could find. And then you can find this hex weave cloth, which is, I don't know, made out of something completely artificial, but it is really lightweight, but it's just this hex weave. And I thought, oh, that'd be absolutely brilliant for the for the planetary shield, because you can kind of see through it, and you can kind of see up and kind of do this thing. So it's like, right, okay, great. And it's really lightweight. And then I thought, but then I've got to string it between these things. But actually, I can drill a hole in the thing. I can put a kind of a loop through. So I can just drill some holes in this plastic stuff. That's fine. I can put a loop through, and then I can get a clip, and then I can clip it on. And actually, that will give me my thing, and it'll hold. And that's like, right, okay. And it's going to be light enough. And even if that falls over and hits a one-year-old, it's like added another 5 grams to the thing. Actually, it's not going to hurt anybody. So great. And then, so I went and looked, and B&Q got them on a half price sale. And so they weren't 30 quid, or they weren't 20 quid. They were 10 quid or 15 quid. And it's kind of like, right, something is telling me that this is the solution. You know, this is fate intervening. So I head straight over to B&Q, pick one up, and then go and hide it somewhere at home so the missus doesn't assemble it and start sticking stuff on it. So it's like, great. And then I find somebody that had created these kind of, I think they're kind of used for camping or mountain climbing, and the guys use it for just clipping things onto backpacks. But they're little bits of wire, and they've kind of got a screw-on piece. So you kind of put them together, and they kind of create a little ring. So you kind of put them on your backpack, and then you can hang stuff off them. And I think people kind of put ice axes or clip stuff on, or carabiners onto the outside of their backpacks, and you can kind of do these things. And the great thing was, you could get them color coordinated or a range of different colors. And I found somebody that was selling something like a 20 pack with them about 6 or 7 different colors. And then I found somebody else that was doing these quick release clips. And again, they were doing them in the identical colors. And that was like, great. So on the corner of my pieces of cloth, I can kind of put these colored quick release clips. And then I can put the same kind of ring onto my struts. And then every time I'm building this, I know exactly which piece is going where in which corner, because it's all color coordinated. It's kind of like, right, great. All right. That's fantastic. Let's do that. And then I just got a simple piece of cloth and got it for black cloth. And that was kind of the top. And that was kind of the going to represent space. And I had these visions that what I was going to do was spec it with paint so that it would kind of look like stars. But I kind of never got around to that. And then I started to panic about cutting these things. So then I wrote my mum into cutting the cloth so that it was exactly the right size. And, you know, because obviously the cloth, you can kind of stretch it and whatever, but she's got these cloth cutting things from her pieces of work on patchwork and stuff. So she's got this enormous L-shaped right angle thing that she can kind of use. And it was great. So she kind of did that. And then she hemmed some of the stuff for me. So that was fantastic. And then that was okay. So that was great. And then I realized, oh, okay, so great, I've sorted that. That's fine. That's cool. Okay, but now I need more of the space stuff. I need the sky. I need the planetary gate. So I ended up on Shapeways again, where there's this guy who's produced an absolutely outstanding model of the Skygate. And not only that, it was the absolutely perfect size for the kind of the board. It was about 20 something centimeters in diameter, and you know the hole where all of the ships kind of go through was 5 centimeters across. And so that's fine, that's absolutely perfect. Let's not talk about the £95 that cost to order the thing. And again, Ruth, that did not happen. So that got posted to me. And then that's great. Okay, so I've got the planetary shield. But what I really need is two star destroyers colliding into each other with a hammerhead, explosions, and imminent collision. And well, then I found this guy on YouTube, and you know, I'd actually found him probably about 6 to 9 months earlier, and I just put it at the back of my mind and thought, when I figure out how I'm going to do this guy in the whatever that is. So again, I got hold of my, I had to order two Star Destroyers, so that was another £30-odd. And then I had to cut one of the Star Destroyers. So I had to take a really big knife to a Star Destroyer and cut a chunk of it out. And then I had to glue the other Star Destroyer into it at an angle. And then I got some cotton wool and some stuff out and sprayed it various colours so it looks like there's an explosion. And I glued some bits into it. And then I scratch built a hammerhead about 1 to 6,000 scale or something like that, but it was literally just using little odds and sods and an awful lot of liquid green stuff just to kind of do this. And then I glued that onto the thing, and then right, okay, so I kind of do that, and then I ordered really fine fishing wire fishing line in order to be able to suspend it, and then tied that on, and then super glued bits, and then I got quick release clips to kind of do that, and then that was it. It's okay, great, and kind of did that, and then I thought, well, actually there's another bit. So I got my ships from my armada and put them on a line, and so I can string some rebel fleet in the space battle. So you've got a Mon Calamari ship and a frigate and a supply ship, and you know, I was thinking about getting the Tantive IV and several of the other things, but I kind of ran out of time, and there was part of me going, oh, I really don't need to spend another 40 or 50 quid on ships for this. And then I got some more of my spare X-Wings and some of my spare TIE fighters, and of that I only had spare TIE fighters, so I ordered some more X-Wings. And then I put a couple more lines across to represent the actual dogfighting that occurs on the planet on the thing. And again, I strung those from fishing line. And you know, that was kind of great. And so I kind of did some stuff. I tested it out. And it turns out that you can't just put these black tubes 5 feet into the air because they lean over at ridiculous angles, and when you hang your cloth from it, they all lean in one angle. So instead of having these kind of vertical supports, you kind of have these 70 degree supports. So what I had to do then was I had to I picked up some pipe from the DIY store, and it's the 10 millimeter or 12 millimeter or 15 millimeter rigid piping, and I'm not sure who uses it or why they use it, but I got hold of some of that, and you can get right angle pieces for junctions. So I got some of that and I cut those to the appropriate length, and then I drilled holes through the junctions, and basically if I put a 4-inch screw through those, I can then put those on top of my other pieces, and actually I complete my box, and it kind of holds everything at probably about an 87 degree angle, and is close enough to the fact that it doesn't look like it's going to fall down. And then the other thing I could kind of do then was, because my cloth was sagging, because holding it in the four corners wasn't great, I could then add about another five or six connection points and then clip that in. And so everything now hangs taut, and actually my cloth holds the whole thing together. So actually everything is mutually supporting and actually stands up very well, which is all great. Until you get to the show and you try and get all of this stuff out, and the really, really fine fishing line is practically invisible. And because your really, really fine fishing line on some of these things is actually 6 feet long, it's got completely entangled with the fishing line that suspends each of your spaceships from the line. And when I got this out at Joy of Six, I had the base, the board, the figures, the table and everything set up in 25 minutes. And I spent the next hour and 35 minutes untangling all of my fishing line. And I did that for a couple of shows until I started going, right, well, this is a problem that requires smartness as opposed to brute ignorance, to kind of thing. And then I figured, actually, if I just get a small stick and every time I take these things down, I actually wind all of the line around this stick, I can actually get it undone. And so I now have it to a point where I can set the whole thing up in about 45 minutes. So my initial thinking was, yes, this is great. It looks wonderful. It's absolutely marvelous. But for the love of all that's holy, don't do it. But with a little bit of thought, you can actually manage it. Kind of putting it all up, I have a board that is 4 feet wide, 6 feet long, and 5 feet high. It's strange as well, because when people kind of come up, they can kind of see all the various bits and pieces. But I have to point things out, because lots of people kind of come and they all photograph the board, and they're kind of aware that there's this stuff up in the air. But I go, don't forget to take a photo of the Star Destroyers colliding, and they're like, oh, you've done that as well. I hadn't noticed. And they come round, and there's this second burst of joy that people have when they kind of come round and kind of do that.
Can we expect, like, in future boards, can we sort of expect, like, working pyrotechnics and just call in the Shaw batteries and, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I have looked at doing that. There are people that do it for the role playing stuff. So you can get these systems for putting out kind of vapor and smoke for people that have been building dungeons and stuff. Yeah. For the role playing games. So I'm not going to say no, but there are no plans currently online for that.
Well, I think we're going to call it there for the end of part one for this chat, if that's all right with you, Charles. And we will have a chat in a couple of weeks time. We can actually talk about how the game played, and because I've managed to play it, and I know you've toured the shows, and also have a bit of a chat about what you're working on for the future, because I know you've got another board that's, we'll say, shoreline adjacent, based at Joy of Six. You thought your 30-odd metres or whatever of shoreline wasn't enough when you'd done for you that board. So hopefully talk to you again in a couple of weeks' time for part two of this one, because we've been recording for like coming up for 3 hours nearly, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Hope you've enjoyed this one too, listeners, and please check out Charles's work on the Facebook group, and also you have your own blog as well, don't you, Charles?
I do. It's www.allhellletloose.co.uk. I've put much more of the detail about how I've done the various bits of the build. It's not quite up to date, but hopefully it will be by the time we get around to part two. anybody that's interested in the kind of the things that I've talked about, I talk about them in a lot more detail on my blog. And if anybody just wants to drop a PM or anything else, you can get to me through the HSG terrain and the main group. And it's always brilliant to get ideas and understand what other people are doing. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Charles. Speak to you soon.
Thanks.